Welcome back to In Conversation, our new series of friendly chats amongst athletics colleagues and collaborators on subjects of personal or professional interest. In lieu of well-worn armchairs positioned next to a crackling fire, we'll make do with Google Hangouts and makeshift desk chairs. In both scenarios, we're wearing slippers. We're joined today by Jason Genevikoff, creative director and co-founder of Athletics, as well as the co-founder of Carlen Parfum and the Graham & Co. Motel in Phoenicia, New York, among many other pursuits and ventures. Thanks for taking the time, Jason.
Thanks for having me.
So we'll just dive right in. You know, before you launched Athletics, you were a professional musician. And I'd love to start at the very beginning by asking you a little bit about your musical upbringing. Was music your primary creative outlet growing up?
It sort of was and it wasn't. I mean, I was always in tons of art classes in school and things like that. So I was very into actually photography. It was kind of my first real like kind of creative pursuit. And I got into music pretty young too. I always loved music and I kind of came to music through a friend's family, actually, like my best friend growing up, like when I was very young, like my parents had a house and his parents lived two doors down and he had a big family and his family was very into music. His dad played bass, his older brother played bass, and then he played bass. So they were a super musical family. And I think just because we were really close friends growing up, that was sort of how I got into actually playing music.
And was yours a musical household growing up? I mean, what was playing on your turntable as a kid in your home?
I mean, I was always obsessed with music, so I always had records. I guess, like, you know, it wasn't like terribly musical in the sense that, like, I think my dad actually had a guitar that he bought in Vietnam when he was there and played guitar a little bit, but that wasn't really part of my musical upbringing or anything. But I mean, I just remember very early, like asking for records, and I had a little turntable and like stealing my sister's records. You know, the really early biggest one that I remember was Prince Purple Rain, which I was completely obsessed with. But like my mom always listened to music. And so, you know, we would always be like singing Air Supply in the car and things like that. But yeah, as I said before, I mean, you know, so I was really into music and I always was asking for records and things like that. But so how I got into playing music was sort of through punk rock, and that was more like a social thing, which was very much through my best friend, Matt, who his family was always into music and he was always playing in bands and he was a few years older than me. So kind of when I was basically, I got into punk rock through him and was always going to shows and really seeing his bands play. And then there was just like a moment where I wanted a guitar and got a guitar. And actually I started playing bass in my first band. I played bass, not guitar, but yeah, it was more of like a weird thing where with punk rock, it wasn't like, oh, I'm a really great musician. Like I never took lessons or anything like that. It was more just like, you can do whatever you want. And so, you know, it was basically like, here, play this instrument and we'll figure out how to be a band. And that's kind of how I started playing music.
So it seems that your interest in like the visual arts and in music existed sort of in parallel throughout your upbringing. And it's interesting because I've found that within our industry, music is a very common either, you know, side passion or a gateway drug kind of into design itself through things like record sleeves. Would you agree with that kind of characterization? And why do you think that is?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it certainly was for me. I mean, especially at that time, like, I guess this was, you know, the late 80s, early 90s was when I was kind of in middle school and high school and getting into punk rock and being kind of like an art class nerd and being obsessed with photography and things like that. And like punk rock. And those were two things. It was sort of like, I guess for both of those, punk rock was really the primary kind of shaping element or experience in both my like design side of my life and also music, which is that you sort of didn't necessarily have to have an education necessarily to do it. The punk rock ethos was very much like just get stuck in. And if it's something that people respond to, then it's valid. Or even just like if it's something that you enjoy doing, it's valid. You sort of didn't need that like external validation so much. So like loving design and being obsessed with design from a very early age, mostly through kind of punk rock design, record sleeves and things like that. It was very much like those two things were kind of like always going at the same time for me. Like one was kind of always influencing the other.
Were there any particular records or bands or even kind of visual artists that were working in the punk space that really struck you in those years?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there was a guy called John Yates, who was a record sleeve designer early on that was very involved in like the punk rock record sleeves. But like, he was kind of was like the first one that had like, or to me anyway, that was like a very like, there's like another level of polish to it. It wasn't like, you know, coming from a place that was mostly like cut and paste flyers. You're like, basically like was essentially collage. Like he kind of started, when I started seeing the record sleeves that he was designing, it was a lot more like put together and polished. And I assumed that he probably had like a design education of some kind. But then I guess I was also, at the same time of kind of getting into punk rock, I was weirdly like got turned on to like the Pet Shop Boys. I was like obsessed with a lot of like British music, and that just had like a completely different aesthetic. But it was very influential for me, because I think as I started to get a little bit, I want to say older, but I was like in my early 20s. But when I started to really start to design record sleeves, which was kind of the first real actual, like, you know, meaningful design that I was doing, I was sort of bringing those influences in too, which was a little bit outside of sort of the typical punk rock visual landscape. Like thinking of things like, you know, Mark Farrow and, you know, Pet Shop Boys sleeves that were a lot more like hyper refined and Swiss and things like that. So yeah, it's interesting.
I'd love to hear a little bit about, you know, when and how you actually got into creating record sleeves. When was it that you were first diving into that particular pursuit?
It was really just that old thing of necessity is the mother of invention. It was like, I was into like art and design and photography. And when I started to have bands and we needed to start having some kind of visual output for like our own record sleeves. And of course, because if you have that sort of DIY ethos where you're like, of course I can just do this. So that was really the first stuff that I started designing, was stuff for my own bands. And then, you know, as that sort of progressed and maybe I started to get a little bit better at it, and then that started to just kind of grow out of that and start doing records for other bands and things like that.
And how did you eventually make that transition from record covers to the field of brand design in a wider sense?
I mean, so when I was kind of playing in the Promise Ring, I was always designing kind of in the downtime. So like, you know, we would kind of have touring cycles and things like that. And I was always designing our own record sleeves, but then I was doing work for other record labels and things like that. When I was home from tour or just in between, trying to sort of build a little bit of a freelance design practice. And I guess when that sort of band ran its course, I was in my late 20s, and I remember thinking like, well, I kind of have a fork in the road now. I can either, you know, the rest of my band members were like, we're starting another band or doing these other things. And I was like, well, I could either start another band and do music. And I very much remember thinking to myself, well, I'm in my late 20s, and like, we had a really great experience and a great run and had moderate success and it paid the bills and things like that. But I was like, you know, the music industry is quite finicky. And I just remember thinking like, A, I wanted a new change and I wanted to move out of New York. So I moved to wanted to move out of the Midwest. So I moved to New York. And B, I was like, I think it's just time to like go in another path. And I don't know that I want music to be the main thing of that path. And I was really excited about like, maybe this is a good chance to get stuck in with design. So, I mean, it was really shortly before Athletics started, actually. Like, I mean, I moved to New York in 2003, and I had known Matt Owens, you know, socially and through music and through punk rock for a lot of years. And I ended up renting a desk from him at his studio. And towards the latter part of that year, he left his then design practice, which was 1-9. And we just had the idea to like, let's get a space and kind of start an ad hoc design collective. And that was really like, it happened quite quickly. And I mean, it's funny later meeting Malcolm Buick and him, I remember, because he sort of had a similar design background of designing records and things like that. And it really was, I remember him saying like, you know, doing branding is sort of like designing record sleeves. It's like, if it works in this small space, it will work, you know, everywhere. And really, like, a lot of the design that I was influenced in later was a lot of that, like, you know, I guess something that was happening in British music design, which is, and maybe European too, but certainly was not a huge thing in the US, was that, like, when bands had records come out, it would be like this, it really was treated more like a brand, in the sense that, like, the record would come out, so the 12-inch, the main release had a record sleeve, and then you had all of these singles that were always related from a design standpoint to this thing. So it was like this whole kind of little, like, brand. And I remember I was really obsessed with this band Travis, and they had, like, a very specific word mark that was their Travis logo, and that was consistent across all of their releases over, like, I don't know, 3 or 4 releases at least at that point. And it was really felt like, it did feel like you were making a brand for a band. So in a lot of senses, it was a pretty natural extension of that. Of course, branding is far more complicated than designing a record sleeve, but yeah, it was a good kernel to kind of latch onto.
Absolutely. And you mentioned this kind of concept of scale, that if a record sleeve design, you know, works well at that particular scale, that, you know, the elements will work well elsewhere in kind of a larger scale. And it's interesting to hear you kind of describe the way that certain English labels were really treating their releases as almost branded launches. Are there any other principles from the kind of craft of record design that you find continue to inform your practice today?
Ooh, that's a good question. I mean, it's such a different landscape now. I'm sorry to say that I actually don't really, it's like now everything just exists in these, you know, Spotify worlds and then digital places. So there's nothing that really, like, springs to mind. I mean, I'm sure people are still doing it. It's just probably a little bit outside my field of vision.
Sure. And I imagine that also there's an element where today the, you know, release of albums is taking a lot of inspiration from what successful brands are doing, as opposed to kind of the other way around, where the world of branding is taking inspiration from the world of music, in thinking about, you know, what an how the artists that are deeply successful today in a popular sense really are, you know, integrated brands in every sense, from having merchandise to, you know, product collaborations, and obviously very kind of well-developed brand identity systems that, like you said, kind of are used across multiple albums.
Yeah, it's funny. It's like a little bit, it almost seems like it's a kind of an inverted starting point, where, you know, there was a time where your first contact with finding anything out about a band was through their record and kind of poring over the notes and things like that, and really having that, like, that physical experience, and everything kind of sprang from that. Whereas now it was a lot more album focused, or even just, like, band focused. And I guess now it's a little bit different, in the sense that, like, albums aren't nearly as important. Tons of artists are just releasing things by, like, you know, as a single song at a time, or a little smaller groups at a time. And it's just kind of a different thing. But then I think that does certainly go out and, you know, affect the visual aesthetic of the band. There's just so many different touch points that didn't exist, you know, 20 years ago.
Absolutely. And I know the answer to this question, but, you know, I wanted to ask you, you know, do you listen to music while you work? And if so, what kinds of things are you listening to?
Yes, I definitely listen to music when I work. It definitely depends on what I'm doing. In the seemingly more rare instances where I'm really sitting down and designing, I always listen to music, just because it's a kind of way to, like, sort of detach your brain and just kind of get into that flow of designing, which is sadly not a super often occurrence for me these days. But I always listen to music. I can't be in a quiet room. So music is always playing, and it kind of just, I guess it flits between, I mean, I listen to a ton of dance music. I'm obsessed with dance music. It's so strange with music these days, because I've noticed my own music habits have changed so much, and it's sometimes hard to find where like once it was always about like albums and I would get obsessed with an album and be listening to that all the time, I'd find myself making a lot more playlists and things. But it definitely spans the gamut of like some days I'm listening to podcasts, some days I'm listening to like classical music, some days I'm listening to jazz, some days I'm listening to electronic music. For me, it's really like music is, it's very tied to like how you feel is like heavily influences like the thing that I want to listen to, or if I need to like not make myself feel a certain way, but like, you know, certainly putting on like a really like upbeat electronic record or dance record is a way of kind of like bringing yourself to life in a way and getting excited about doing something. Whereas if I need to be like calm and focused, maybe it's something more like jazz or something like that.
And I'd love to, you know, shift gears a little bit. You know, in addition to athletics, you've pursued a number of successful entrepreneurial ventures like the Graham & Co. Motel in Phoenicia, New York, as well as the genderless fragrance line, Carlin Parfum. Tell me a bit about what motivated you to create these brands respectively.
I guess the genesis for each of them was quite different, but I think that going back to kind of what we were talking about earlier with just that kind of like impulse of DIY, which was definitely baked into me as a young man. I'm always just really curious about how things work. Frankly, like I want to know, it's kind of the thing that gets me excited about like trying any certain thing, whether that's like pottery or photography or fragrance. Like it's, I just get excited about like trying to unravel a mystery and understand how something works. And obviously, like the more creative it is, kind of the more fun it is. For the hotel, that was a really organic thing. It was like, I mean, I love interiors and I love interior design and architecture and things like that. And that hotel came about through a couple friends of ours that had a house near us upstate, and their family had been in real estate. And it was really kind of off the cuff thing where they had found this hotel and thought, oh, this could be an interesting, fun project for them. And the four of us, me, Jeff, and Bianca and Amanda, this was Bianca's family that kind of bought and got the property and did all the construction and the management of the business itself. But they sort of approached us, were like, if we do this thing, would you guys want to design this? And so, and we were like, this is something that we all love. We all love to travel and we all love interiors and design and branding and fashion. And it was just like a really good confluence of all these different things that we loved. So yeah, that project was, like I said, it was very organic and natural. It just kind of happened. And it was like an idea that turned into something a little bit more. And then of course, years later, we were like, oh, we're opening this hotel and this is kind of crazy and fun and exciting. And yeah, so that was a good experience. I think with a hotel is really fun because there's so many different touch points that are exciting to work on, which is, you know, everything from interior design to product development to experience, tons of print collateral, et cetera. And then that actually sort of led into the fragrance. So as part of the hotel, I was always obsessed with fragrance, and Jeff and I had taken a fragrance development class just kind of on a lark for fun. And I just started getting obsessed with it and started doing tons of research and buying all those materials. And so we were just kind of like, it was a weekend hobby really. And we were like always making these fragrances for friends and things. And then we had the idea to like, you know, blend up a bunch of these, and they were small batch, and we were putting them in the hotel and selling them at the hotel. And after those started to take a little bit of, get a little momentum and people were responding to them, we were like, oh, we should actually really do this. My partner, Jeff, was in fashion, had a store, and we were like, we kind of have an outlet for this and we understand, you know, the production end of it, or what we thought we did. And that took a lot of figuring out. It was a huge challenge, but a very big learning experience. But I just was always obsessed with fragrance, and fragrance is one of those things. It's very similar to music in the sense that like there is, you know, with both music and fragrance, there's a huge technical side of it. Like you can be wildly educated and technical and well practiced and make this thing that's like really beautiful, or you can be really well practiced and make something that's actually really subjectively horrible. But also the flip side of that is you can also be totally naive and make a really amazing piece of music. You can be totally naive and make like a really beautiful smelling fragrance, because it's largely subjective. You know, if you smell it that smells good to you, then, you know, who's to say that it's not a valid thing? So that just got me really excited. And so we were kind of starting to make all those fragrances. And as it got to be more of a thing, we just decided one day, like, let's build a brand around this and actually start doing this in earnest. So that's kind of how Carlin was started.
So interesting. You know, the Graham & Co. I think has become somewhat indicative of this interesting kind of creative renaissance upstate, which I think is absolutely being accelerated by the pandemic kind of driving people out of New York, you know, and as people sort of seek refuge in these more socially distant kind of communities in the Hudson Valley and the Catskills. Were you aware at the time of kind of launching and developing the Graham & Co. that there was something really interesting happening in that region that was going to, you know, make it so people were going to be coming up and looking for a kind of a stylish, aesthetically pleasing place to stay?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was sort of a well-informed hunch, but at the time, I guess we had had a house up there for, I don't know, it was a handful of years, maybe 4 or 5 years, and we just knew tons of our friends. I guess we noticed over that time period that a lot more people were coming up there, and where, you know, at one point everyone was just going to the Hamptons, or that just was the one of the closer kind of like local destinations for, like, if you're going to do like a weekend away, you could go to the Hamptons. And we definitely noticed that there was a lot more people coming up, and they were like, you know, we were living in, I guess, probably Williamsburg at the time, and that sort of whole creative kind of class, and was, we could tell they were coming there, and they were interested in this sort of romantic, you know, I guess, non-urban getaway. But then also a lot of those people also still want some of the trappings of, like, you know, a nice hotel amenities. So the Graham & Co. was really an exercise in kind of marrying those two things of, like, something that gives you some of those trappings of, like, we've left New York, but we still understand what this is. So there's, like, good coffee or some interesting merchandise and things like that. And the rooms were nice enough, but there were still no TVs and things like that. So it was sort of a way of getting your weekend away, but something that wasn't just in a dusty old cabin. It was a little bit more refined than that.
Right. And it's so interesting to think about it in the context of the history of hospitality in the Catskills, with the obviously iconic old, you know, Jewish lodges and the Borscht Belt, you know, being this kind of interesting incubator for comedy talent. And then the Catskills also later, you know, being a place where artists would go to sort of get out of the limelight, where they could focus and create. And I'm thinking specifically of the band and Bob Dylan. And it's just interesting to see how that kind of creative history and history of hospitality converged a little bit in the creation of the Graham & Co. And I think you guys referenced that almost a little bit in the branding and some of the messaging that accompany the hotel.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I guess the area always had a history of all of those things. And for whatever reason, people stopped going, and that just kind of turned a little bit. And but now it's definitely having a renaissance, for sure. I mean, I think that, you know, when the Graham & Co. opened, I think that there weren't that many hotels like that. There might have only been a couple, and certainly nowhere near Phoenicia. But since then, lots of hotels have opened up. There's lots of demand, and it's just a place where people are excited to get out to.
Absolutely. You know, I'm curious if your experience creating and managing brand identities for your own businesses informs the work that you do for clients, ranging from Samsung to IBM to Citrix and beyond.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think a lot of the client work that we do has informed, I guess, yeah, they it's a cyclical thing, really. You know, I mean, I think that a lot of the work that we do and things that we learn and understand by doing work for our clients can be brought to bear on those practices, and vice versa. I mean, even if it's something as somewhat banal as, like, if we're working for a brand who has, like, a packaging need, and having learned the mechanics of, like, fragrance production and packaging production and things like that, they definitely, it's sort of like the snake eating its tail, you know, it's always kind of like tumbling together, and then one informs the other, and vice versa.
Right. And I think you've probably also had a lot of the myths of entrepreneurship, you know, kind of dispelled by actually going through those processes yourself. So you really know what it takes, you know, whether it's financially or in terms of, you know, the time, resources to actually get something off the ground. And I'm sure that that makes it so you can kind of spot, you know, a potential partner that actually has kind of what it takes versus someone who's, you know, has a vision, but not necessarily the kind of resources or structure to actually make something happen.
Yeah, certainly. And I think also it's, I mean, for a certain type of our clients, like just that excitement and curiosity about making something from nothing and turning a brand into a brand, you know, there's an empathy part of it too, which we can definitely empathize with them and like the struggles and the and all the work that it takes and kind of the to and fro nature of, you know, one step forward, two steps back, and all of those things that it takes to kind of create a business from nothing is you know, certainly good emotional understanding to like empathize with them on their journeys too.
Absolutely, in the sense that the brands are reflections of people's vision, therefore reflections of people, and it becomes very personal, especially when it's a, you know, an entrepreneur, and we're working with them. So being able to understand that definitely informs our process and a lot of the work that we do upfront in terms of strategy and how we kind of bring that through design technology. And is there anything on the horizon that you know are eyeing? Any extracurricular projects that are occupying you outside of athletics these days?
I mean, I think that I have plenty of irons in the fire, probably arguably too many. But no, I think that, you know, still we're slowly building Carlin into something bigger. That sort of lives in a world where it's, you know, half hobby, half passion project, half real business, which is nice. It's a good place for that to live. Outside of that, I've just been really into a bunch of real estate projects, actually, like buying houses, flipping houses, and selling them. In the Catskills, have a project that's just about to kick off, and working on one in Palm Springs as well right now. So those are always fun.
Fantastic. So taking kind of a long view of your career over the past few decades, you know, you've moved through music to design to real estate to fragrances, back to real estate and beyond. Do you sort of see a common thread running through these various, you know, projects and chapters?
I mean, I think it's just moving from one thing that feels exciting and that you can be passionate about to another, and trying not to ever have a job that's just a boring job that you're doing. I mean, I think probably you could boil it down to my entire professional career has been avoiding actually having a job and always being my own boss and being able to do mostly the things that I just want to do, and staying excited and passionate about the work that you're doing. So that's certainly the case with athletics and all of these projects. I mean, I guess, yeah, that's probably the common thread, and curiosity, just, you know, always trying to like figure things out and make something that's interesting and that resonates with people, hopefully.
Absolutely. And, you know, you've been witness to an actual, you know, player within this really fascinating period in our industry, in the creative field, with the ascendance of digital, the explosion of social media, the kind of rise and plateau and sort of anticipated potentially, you know, fall of this sort of direct consumer brand kind of way of going to market and so on. How would you characterize the current state of our field, if that's even possible?
Yeah, that's a big question. I mean, I think it's less about characterizing it as a singular thing and more, there's lots of different observations. I mean, I think, yeah, having been doing athletics for, you know, getting on nearly two decades and working in this field, there's been so many, you know, different changes and things that seemed probably not obvious at the time and more obvious in hindsight. I mean, I think the whole, the last probably 5-6 years of startup culture and a lot of these startup brands, certainly from a visual standpoint, I mean, something that everyone's talking about is the kind of like homogenization of design in that kind of realm is, I think, starting to loosen up and people are getting bored. I think part of it is an interesting thing with design, and that, like, you know, when I started doing design, I remember I was obsessed with Vaughn Oliver, who's a designer from the UK and did a most if not all of the 4AD records. So I was obsessed with Von Oliver, and I remember like, you know, this is the 90s and I was living in the Midwest and there weren't like amazing art bookshops like there are in New York. And I had to like scour the earth to find this book that he made, you know, as like a singular point of reference, you know, whereas of course now, like everything with the internet, you can find everything at your fingertips at any time. And I think it's just increased this, like the cycle of trends getting eaten up and spit back out. And I think that's kind of where a lot of that homogenization lies. But I think, you know, people are starting to get bored with that. And I think, yeah, I don't know where that will go. I mean, I think people are definitely wanting something more real. They don't want it to just look like something that they would align themselves with. They want actual brands that have real beliefs and actually are doing something meaningful rather than just looking like they're doing something meaningful. So that's certainly one thing. I mean, I think so much crazy digital technology happening with augmented reality and virtual reality and stuff that, you know, even 18 months ago seemed more like science fiction than reality is all of a sudden like, oh, wow, these things are actually real and can be used by brands really in the everyday and really in meaningful ways. And that's super exciting and something that I think certainly for the athletics that we're trying to get you know, more of a handle on and move into that territory, because it's just, you know, kind of an uncharted thing that seemed the same way that, you know, digital and website design seemed in the late 90s, early 2000s as the sort of like wizard's work that was, you know, hard to really wrap your hands around or your head around. And I think that stuff is happening now, but it's a little bit more knowable, which is exciting. So I don't know. Those are two sort of relatively broad thoughts.
Sure. And, you know, you don't strike me as someone who spends a lot of time, you know, kind of gazing wistfully into the past, but is there anything that you miss or think we need to relearn from your early days in the creative industry?
That is a good point. I mean, I certainly don't dwell in the past. I mean, I think, I don't know if it's for, you know, our work in the day-to-day or for the industry per se. I mean, I think any opportunity to do things with, you know, in physical spaces with your hands, not staring at the computer, is not necessarily important for your actual work output, but more for your mental health. I think that, just any time that you can spend not staring at the screen and thinking about things more is probably something that I miss. I don't spend a lot of time, especially now during COVID, not staring at the computer. It seems more and more like our everyday constant thing. So hopefully we can get a little bit of a step away from that. It'll be good for everybody, I think.
Absolutely. I'm with you on that hunger for tactility. I think in a world where everything is, you know, we're consuming content primarily on these very sleek, you know, flat surfaces, having, you know, experiences that bring us into the world of three dimensions is always really exciting and very kind of grounding. And I feel like we're doing a lot more work in the physical space as well as an agency.
Yeah, for sure. And I think even just for humans in general, it's like more actual real human connections and less living in a technological dreamscape or a technological death cult, depending on your perspective, is good.
From your mouth to God's ears. Thank you. Thank you so much, Jason, for joining me today on In Conversation. And thank you for all who have tuned in to listen. Please stay tuned on our social media channels to hear about upcoming conversations, podcasts, events, editorial posts. We really appreciate it. And we'll talk to you soon.